So Brian and Susan asked me to give the last talk and to try and provide some context for all the things that we heard about in the session. And so when I looked over the abstracts and thought about this, I thought that striking the theme of the importance of natural soil and plant processes in urban ecosystems might be a good theme for summarizing what we heard. Oh, it worked out better than I thought, right, because the talks all really struck that theme quite well. So we'll talk a little bit about what we heard and then provide some broader context for this, and I'm hoping to do that in the context of this National Science Foundation-funded project called the Baltimore Long-Term Ecological Research Project. It's called the Baltimore Ecosystem Study. So what did we hear about today, right? So again, we have this trying to strike this theme of the importance of natural soil and plant processes in urban ecosystems. And we started right off, right? So Susan starts talking about we have this engineering mindset, which is causing problems for us in urban systems because there are very important soil processes, microbial processes, plant processes. And if we think just in an engineering mindset, then we're going to miss those. We're going to, and as I'm going to try and point out, we're going to miss opportunities for improving the environmental performance of these urban systems. And that's shown super well in Doug's turfgrass example. So turfgrass is extremely common cover, and we're fighting these huge forces of runoff, right? So you think about runoff in urban watersheds, it's just a challenge. I mean, you have impervious surface, you have lots of water, and if we manage the turfgrass well with stem density and healthy turf stands and infiltration rates, and we manage the natural soil and plant processes, we're going to get vastly improved environmental performance. And that was shown super well in Doug's talk. But of course, the devil's in the details. And so there are these processes, whether it's infiltration or whether it's plant uptake or whether it's decomposition, as Ian talked about. If we really want to use these natural soil and plant processes, we're going to have to get down into the weeds and really understand things about rates of decomposition and other biological processes, and I'll give some more examples of those. The wetlands example is fantastic. I'm going to give some other wetland examples today. They're probably the most obvious biological hotspots in urban areas, and so they're naturally, people are naturally drawn to them. Wetlands do what they do. Was that what the to me, the wetlands are almost a gimme example of the importance of natural soil and plant processes. But of course, they are complicated a little bit. And then I thought it was great to end with the question of urban agriculture, because that's really where we're trying to put a lot of our knowledge to use, and that there's this incredible increase in interest in the production of food in cities. And so in order to make that, to understand what the capacity for production of food in cities is, and to understand and to determine if that's safe, then we're going to have to understand these natural plant and soil processes, just like kind of talked about. Uptake of metals, dynamics of metals and soil. So I thought we had just a great mixture of topics demonstrating the importance of natural soil and plant processes in urban watersheds. I think the ongoing challenge then is to put all those things together, and I'm going to try and give an example of how we've approached this in the Baltimore project, in particular by applying the watershed approach as a tool for integrating and scaling to larger areas. And as an example, I'm going to talk about where does all the nitrogen go, and this kind of mystery about where does all the nitrogen go in these urban watersheds, and it has forced us to think, where is it in lawn, streams, riparian, and floodplains? So I'll try and give some examples of that. Just to introduce the watershed approach, very common in ecosystem ecology, is to use a watershed as a unit of study. And we can sample the quantity and the quality of the water coming out of the watershed to learn something about the structure and function of that watershed. And we frequently apply disturbance. So we disturb these watersheds, and we look at the response of the watershed. And then we ask questions. So we then pose hypotheses about what are the internal dynamics of the system that cause the response to disturbance. So watershed approach, very useful in applying disturbance and response and then testing hypotheses about internal mechanisms. Watershed approach also very useful in a long-term mode as we see changes in ecosystems in response to more subtle changes in the environment, whether it's changes in climate or changes in atmospheric chemistry. Watershed approach has been very useful for this. This develops in forests. So this is a picture from another long-term ecological research site, the Hubbard Brook site in New Hampshire. And these are watersheds are all about 20 hectares in size. You can see they applied various treatments to these watersheds, sampling the quantity and the quality of the water down at the bottom of these watersheds, comparing the treated watersheds with a variety of reference uncut watersheds. And this is an approach that's been very, very useful for studying whole ecosystem function in natural systems. And the way this works is you start off, you have a reference watershed, you have a treated watershed, you collect data for a few years to see that the watersheds are the same. You apply the treatment. So here we're measuring nitrate, which is a great water quality concern in cities. So you have a few years of pre-treatment data. You cut the watershed down, the nitrate concentration goes up. Then when the vegetation begins to regrow, the nitrate concentration comes down, and you can then follow. That's a classic watershed experiment. Now, when we started studying urban systems and urban watersheds from an ecosystem point of view, we were very curious to know if you cut down the forest and replace it with a city, what would happen? Would the nitrate concentration go up super high and never come down, or would it not go up much at all? And so we had a basis. You know, we understood how forest watersheds work, and we wanted to use that as a platform for studying how cities as ecosystems would work. So we did that in Baltimore. So this is a map of Baltimore County. This is the city of Baltimore here. And we focus on this watershed here, the Gwynns Falls watershed, which starts out in the kind of rural suburban fringe, goes down into the older suburbs of the city, and then goes down here and ends in the inner harbor of Baltimore, where the Orioles play, and they didn't win any games in that last series, but we're going to gloss over that. And we set up a lot of monitoring stations along the Gwynns Falls. So it's a long-term study, and we sample this watershed. We start here at the top. We sample about a quarter of the way down. We sample half the way down. We sample down at the bottom. You can see we also have a bunch of watersheds outside the Gwynns Falls. So we have a forested reference watershed. We have a bunch of small watersheds of urban, suburban, different configurations, so that we can compare these different land use configurations on a variety of watershed processes. Again, whole watershed processes. So, and we've been at this since 1998. So we've been sampling every week since 1998. And here's, again, this is nitrate. And Baltimore drains into the Chesapeake Bay. And there's tremendous interest in keeping nitrate out of the Chesapeake Bay. And here's three of our streams. So here's a forested reference watershed, has very low nitrate concentrations, it's not a surprise. It's like many forested watersheds we've studied. Our agricultural watershed here has very high nitrate concentrations, which is also not a surprise. These concentrations are typical of the ag watersheds that we have studied in the past in Maryland and elsewhere. Our topic is this suburban watershed in the middle. Clearly has higher nitrate concentrations than the forested watershed. It clearly has lower nitrate concentrations than the agricultural watershed. Of course, people hate this result. So I present this result, and I frequently get in a lot of trouble with this result. Why do I get in trouble with this result? Any ideas? Why would this result cause problems?
One is because the urban nutrient management isn't heavily regulated, and so people say, oh, you're losing it all from home lawns.
Well, it doesn't. People would like to say that, but this data suggests that all you need to do is get rid of those damn farms and replace them with nice condominiums, and then your Chesapeake Bay problem is solved. And that's a problematic result because we need farms for a variety of reasons. But the most important thing about this slide is we use this as a platform for asking questions. And this is what's great about the watershed approach, and it's great about long-term data. We stare at that data and we say, why? Why is the suburban higher than the forest and lower than the agriculture? What is causing this long-term decline in the suburban watershed? What is causing these changes in the ag watershed? What causes the seasonal patterns? The power of long-term data is it gives you a chance to say why, pose hypotheses, and then we've been blessed with really good students and postdocs to go out and then ask these questions. The other tool that we use to guide our watershed studies is we construct nitrogen balances. It's an old tool in soil and watershed studies where we look at inputs, we look at outputs in the stream, and then we calculate this retention, or the ability of the watershed ecosystem to hold on to nitrogen. If you look at a forest, we have inputs from the atmosphere only, we have very low outputs in stream flow, as I showed you, and lots of retention. 94% of the nitrogen that goes into a forested watershed is retained in that watershed, and that's a very important ecosystem service that forests provide. But what's really interesting is the suburban watershed, right? So it's got the inputs from the atmosphere. It has inputs, fertilizer to home lawns. So the inputs are higher. The outputs in the stream are higher, as I showed you in the previous slide. And the retention is lower. The retention is 70% instead of 90%. But we were shocked at how high the retention was. We expected, this is a very heavily human-modified system, and we expected basically it was going to function as a flow-through system with maybe 10 or 20% retention, but instead the budget suggests that 70% of the nitrogen that enters this watershed is being stored in there somewhere. And that's a very important ecosystem service, and we needed to say, well, where is the nitrogen being stored? How can we protect that function? How can we improve that function to improve the nitrogen performance of the watersheds? So these budgets were a very useful tool for again, get out of the lab, you lazy students, and find out where the nitrogen is being retained in these watersheds. We also see that there's a lot of spatial and temporal variation in retention. Retention it goes down as precipitation goes up. So over the last 10 or 12 years or so, we've had quite a range of precipitation. And in all these watersheds, retention goes down as precipitation goes up. The water flushes nitrogen through the system. And this has been seen in many studies. Even in the forested watershed here, there's a significant decline with precipitation. But you'll notice that the response to precipitation is much more marked in the suburban and urban watersheds. So there's an interaction between climate and land use. Land use change makes these watersheds much more susceptible to the climate, the hydroclimate variability. So these urban watersheds, the retention goes down a lot as precipitation goes up. And the forested watersheds are a little more buffered. You still see the effect. But the real thing that I think is interesting in this slide is that the retention is just, it's a lot higher than we expected. Some of these are really urban watersheds, and more than half of the nitrogen in most years is being retained somewhere in the watershed. So the question is where? So we've spent the last 15 years trying to figure out where is this nitrogen being retained in watersheds. A lot of it we think is being retained in soils under turf grass, underneath the home lawns. So we sample. We take samples down to a meter in lots of lawns. So here we have, this is total carbon. Kilograms per hectare of carbon in the soil down to 1 meter. This is the mean from 33 residential lots in a variety of different neighborhoods versus 8 forested reference sites. Here's carbon and here's nitrogen. And there's more soil carbon in the profiles of these residential lawns than there is in the forest. And then an even bigger difference in nitrogen. And then a lot of the fertilizer nitrogen that has been added to these lawns is being stored in these lawns. This is consistent with other talks we heard in this session and also the talks yesterday. And again, this is actual residential lawns. Even more surprising is that a lot of this nitrogen and carbon seems to be accumulating at depth. So we sample down to a meter, and we look at 0 to 10, 10 to 30, 30 to 70, 70 to 100, and a lot of the extra carbon and a lot of the extra nitrogen that's accumulating in these soil profiles seems to be accumulating at surprising depth. And that's a surprise to us because it's not like there's more roots down there. So it's either got to be a change in decomposition of roots or it's got to be some type of leaching and sorption of DOC as it moves down. There's a bunch more. It's really interesting in these turf soils. One other thing that maybe we can have discussion about is, you know, we've been sampling a lot of actual residential lots and comparing them with forests, and we don't see compaction. Right, so we got to talk about bulk density. We got to talk about site preparation. In most of the neighborhoods that we work in, yeah, the area right around the house is compacted, but the vast majority of lawn soil profiles that we see have nice bulk densities and relatively intact soil profiles. And so this is another kind of, to me, as a research frontier, is what, how can we understand the variation in construction practices and soil conditions across the urban landscape. Okay, so we found quite a bit of nitrogen accumulating in lawn soils. We're also very interested in off-site dynamics, and this has, again, been applied in agricultural landscapes. Nitrogen escapes from crop fields. Does it get removed somehow in riparian zones or in the streams? In particular, there's been lots of interest in riparian zones. They have a shallow water table. These are riparian wetlands. There's anaerobic soil, so there's lots of this denitrification, which converts nitrate into nitrogen gas. And we hypothesized that maybe a lot of the nitrogen was disappearing in riparian zones in urban areas, but that was until we went out and looked at the riparian zones in urban areas, and they look like this. A lot of them are very degraded, and you put impervious surface in watersheds, And you're moving water into these streams with a lot of energy. And it incises the streams and it degrades the stream banks. And you end up with, they're almost like drainage ditches in agricultural areas. And we actually determined that these riparian areas actually function more as sources for nitrogen, as old nitrogen is decomposing and mineralizing in these profiles, than sinks. And so the lawns were more of a sink than we thought, and the riparian areas were more of a source than we thought. But we became very interested, because these streams are unstable, we became very interested in stream restoration. So in cities across the country, municipalities are restoring streams to protect infrastructure next to the streams in particular. And some of these restoration designs are creating connections between the stream and the floodplain. So you can see in this restoration, as the stream goes up during a storm, it's designed to shoot water out into the floodplain. And they're actually trying to dissipate some of this runoff energy as it moves through the watershed. It's a very clever idea. But we were wondering if this was going to create riparian wetland conditions and then re-establish some of this riparian sink. And we've been measuring denitrification in these systems. Again, denitrification is an anaerobic microbial process, converts nitrate into nitrogen gas. We have this push-pull method, which I won't bore you with, but it provides in-situ measurements of denitrification in riparian groundwater. And we've been measuring it. And when we go out, we would see that where they would make these connected banks, where they would deliberately engineer a connection between the stream and the riparian zone, we always measured the highest denitrification in these areas. And so this, again, is kind of an engineering mindset mixed in with the natural processes, suggesting that we can merge those two and get a nitrogen benefit. So we became very interested in this idea of connections between stream and riparian zones. Taking a page from the Des Plaines River, where they did this, the idea of get the water out of the stream altogether and create floodplain wetlands. There's a surprising amount of this in urban watersheds. As we restore these streams, we can create accidental or incidental wetlands when these streams are rerouted. And there's also a lot of construction in wetlands in urban areas. And as Jim pointed out, these floodplain wetlands can become important nitrogen sinks if you can get a lot of water in them, if you can hold the water in there for a certain amount of time, and if you can foster biological processing. These floodplain wetlands can be important nitrogen sinks. So we had a student, Melanie Harrison, did her dissertation focused on this restored stream mine bank run. And so here's the stream channel. This is the restored stream channel, and the stream used to run through this floodplain here. And when they restored the stream, it made an oxbow wetland. There's a seepage face that connects the stream to the wetland, and during storm events, it overflows into the wetland. And then just upstream, there's this other one. Again, here's the restored channel this way, and this is the old channel. And during high flow, water backs up into this wetland, or it also overflows from the front. And these are classic. They look like regular oxbow wetlands, but they're in an urban context, so there's a lot more interaction between the stream and the wetland. And again, Melanie hypothesized that these could be important nitrogen sinks in this watershed. So she started making measurements, and like in Jim's case, it's fine if you start to make measurements and then you find out. She started sampling, getting routine sampling of the surface water. So look at nitrate, which is what we're very much interested in the Chesapeake Bay. So in the water column of these wetlands, the nitrate is very low. The nitrate's lower than in the stream water, and is lower than the groundwater, which is the other source of water into these wetlands. And so this strongly suggests that these wetlands are indeed sinks for nitrate. But the phosphorus, again, is the same problem. You look at the phosphorus in the water column of the oxbows is higher than in the stream or higher than in the groundwater, and it would suggest that, like in this prairie slough wetland, or I forget what it's called, but a lot of times these wetlands, the sediments have legacy phosphorus in them from agriculture or from erosion. Anaerobic conditions mobilizes that phosphorus and it comes out. Melanie also made measurements of denitrification in these wetlands. So she did sampling. She applied this denitrification method. These are the oxbow wetlands. Also, there are many constructed stormwater wetlands. And they have very high denitrification rates. She made denitrification measurements both in the summer and the winter, and the rates in the oxbow wetlands were high. The rates in the constructed wetlands were high relative to some natural wetlands. And so indeed, these are sites that have a significant potential for denitrification. There's some concern about nitrous oxide yield. I don't want to talk too much about nitrous oxide, but there's this idea that we can solve a nitrate water quality problem and create a greenhouse gas problem. The response to that is usually, well, you paid me to solve a water problem. If you give me more money, I'll solve the nitrous oxide problem. Here, we don't seem to be creating a nitrous oxide problem. These sites are having a lot of denitrification with a very low yield of N2O, which is a good result. Melanie also did work, to take multiple approaches to study the biology in these wetlands. So she added N15 to these wetlands. She also added rhodamine as a tracer to see where was the nitrogen going in these wetlands. Certainly, a lot was going to denitrification. She was also interested where the algae and the macrophytes taking up some in addition to denitrification. And again, it's important to do this all year, because we know that a lot of the water and a lot of the contaminants in urban areas are moving during the dormant season. And so we can engineer sinks that work in the middle of the summer, but if all the contaminants are moving through the watershed during the winter, we need... So she did some growing season and some winter measurements. You can see in the summer, all the N15 that she added disappeared. A lot of it was taken up by algae and macrophytes. Most of it was denitrified. In the spring, or really kind of the dormant season, the macrophytes and the algae are much less active, but the denitrification is. Denitrification is pretty active at low temperature in both of her studies. So we see that these wetlands have a very high potential for nitrogen removal. There's concerns about phosphorus, but these are things that we can combine an engineering mindset with our understanding of natural soil and plant processes, and we can learn some things. So some conclusions that hopefully we can pick up in our panel discussion. I think that we've seen that there's lots of biology, lots of soil science, lots of biogeochemistry that goes on in urban watersheds. The natural fluxes, whether it's water or nutrients, nitrogen or phosphorus or carbon, they're big, even compared to the engineered fluxes. So we tend to think that it's really all just food in, sewage out, or it's fertilizer use, or it's fossil fuel combustion. But the natural fluxes of carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus in urban watersheds, they're big. They contribute to the environmental performance of these watersheds, and we need to protect them, and we need to manage them, and we need to improve them if we really want to improve the environmental performance of these watersheds. And I think the topics that we had today were all great examples. We certainly heard a lot about struggling with soil conditions, and with plant dynamics and wetland processes and other natural processes. And I think it's an exciting area. I think it's going to keep us busy for a while to come. Thank you for your attention.